Hungry beetles from Asia eat through forests from Chicago to New York. Fire ants from South America burn their way through the Deep South. The prolific weed from the Balkans infests millions of acres in California. It seems as though invasive species are finding their way into every neighborhood in this new world order of open borders. And so today we ask, should we tolerate or eliminate?
Welcome to the award-winning Food Chain Show with your host, Michael Olson. Now, get ready for an hour of What's Eating What Radio.
Well, hello out there. You are tuned into the 584th edition of the Food Chain right here on News Talk Radio. Or hey, perhaps you're among our friends way down there in Ushuaia who are tuned in as we stream along on the Food Chain page at metrofarm.com. Well, whoever you are and wherever you are, welcome aboard. I am Michael Olson, your host for this hour of What's Eating What Radio with engineer Nikki James on the boards.
Hello, Michael.
Producer Carol Stafford.
Hello.
Parmalee Taff is out on special assignment today, but we do have you. Folks, there is an estimated 50,000 non-native species of living things in the United States, and of those, 500 or so are considered to be invasive, which is to say they spread prolifically, undesirably, and perhaps harmfully. Though relatively few in number, a Cornell University study estimates that invasive species like the glassy-winged sharpshooter cause over $138 billion in environmental and economic damage every year and are said to be the second leading cause after habitat loss of native species being listed as endangered or threatened. During a recent Food Chain segment on one invasive species, the light-brown apple moth, we came to the realization that some do not believe we should manage invasive species. In fact, some maintain that to call a non-native species invasive is to be unnecessarily discriminatory. And they seem to be saying we should simply allow Mother Nature to take her course and adapt accordingly. But wait, others say, we simply must manage those invasives or they will eat us out of house and home. We must do everything we can to keep them out. And when they do get in, we must do everything we can to eliminate them. And so today we pause to ask, should invasive species be tolerated or eliminated? Here to help us explore the question, we have David Theodoropoulos, author of Invasion Biology. David, welcome to the Food Chain.
Well, thanks for having me.
Did I get your right last name right?
Oh, yeah, close enough for ranch work, as we
well,
say.
Pronounce it once right
okay.
For me.
Theodoropoulos.
Okay, Theodoropoulos.
Yeah, close enough, yeah. you may, as my father used to say, you may pronounce it however you wish.
Okay, good. Invasion biology. What are you talking about?
Well, invasion biology is a field that's arisen in, it's a subset of ecology that deals with these so-called invasive species. It's kind of interesting. The full title of my book is Invasion Biology, Critique of a Pseudoscience, because if you examine the underpinnings of this field, you find that it's essentially pseudoscientific. There are a lot of technical things, reasons for this that we can go into later, but it's really not a valid field.
Okay. David, we always ask our guest who pays the way, so who pays your way? Are you getting a grant from Monsanto?
Absolutely not. I have never accepted a penny of corporate or government money in my life.
And you're doing this on your own?
Yes, I'm an independent conservation biologist. I make my living. I run a small public access conservation seed bank. It's like the... people have probably heard of the new seed bank that's going in up in in Norway to protect seed, or perhaps they've heard of the Seed Savers Exchange, which deals with preserving heirloom vegetables. Mm-hmm. It's that same sort of thing.
Good. And you're on the West Coast, La Honda, California?
Yeah, that's correct.
Okay, let's go to the East Coast and say hello to Lori Williams, who's the Executive Director of the National Invasive Species Councils. Lori, welcome to the Food Chain.
Thank you so much for having me.
The National Invasive Species Council. What
that's
is
it.
That? What is that?
The National Invasive Species Council is a coordinating group working with all the major federal agencies dealing with invasive species, which, amazingly enough, is 13 federal departments and agencies. And we primarily work on coordination, planning, international cooperation. We work with all the agencies that actually have the regulatory authority and the administrative responsibility to deal with invasive species.
Well, being a government agency, I guess we know who pays your way, right?
You certainly do.
Okay, good. Also with us today, folks, is you, the listener. We have, folks, we have 500 non-native species here in the United States that are said to be doing about $168 billion in damage every year. Should these invasive species be tolerated or eliminated? Phone numbers today, 800-624-2665 and 831-479-1080. Let's start off with the big question. David, I came across you when I was I ran across something called the white paper, and you're leading the effort to not have the white list, I guess it is. What is it exactly, a white list, and what are we talking about here?
Okay. Under current laws, we regulate species under so-called blacklists. This means that if there is a species that is a known problem, like a known weed or a known pest insect, we have what's called a blacklist. This is a list of the species that are known to be harmful, and we prohibit or regulate them.
That's kind of like the terrorist watch list, right?
Yeah, exactly. Now, a white list sort of turns that on its head. It considers all species guilty until proven innocent. And the white list would mean that the government, instead of drawing up a list of problems, will draw up a list of things that are allowed.
Mm-hmm.
You see, it's like rather than prohibiting a limited number of species and everything else is permitted,
so
anything that is not on the list of permitted species are then prohibited.
So. Everybody would be on the terror watch list, and except for those who have proven themselves to be innocent.
Correct.
Huh. Now, so who has a white list?
Well, let's see. Australia, New Zealand, and South Africa have all instituted this, and those countries are being held up as models for our country. And just to give you a little idea of how serious this is, it's for example, in New Zealand, it costs 30,000 New Zealand dollars, which is about 20-some thousand U.S. dollars, to get permission to bring in a new crop species. So something, you know, a very valuable medicinal plant, like everyone, I'm sure, knows about echinacea or something like that. It would cost a person $20,000 to $30,000 to get permission.
You know, I always, in driving through New Zealand, I always wondered how they kept it so darn orderly, and I guess I know now. So, are we doing this here? Are we thinking about doing it here, David?
Let's see. We are supposed to be instituting a white list here in this country. The current the National Invasive Species Council (NISC). Their plan includes what they call risk assessment. Now they've it was originally called a white list, but after I started objecting to it and doing activism against it, they're now deceiving the public by saying, "Oh no, this is just risk assessment." But it's the same thing. They're instituting it one way or another.
Well, let's turn to the National Invasive Species Council. Lori Williams, are you sneaking around here?
Thank you so much. Let me talk a little bit. There, as David said, there currently is no white list in the country. So I just want people to understand that, first of all.
Are you thinking about having one?
Well, what we are thinking about, and Australia and New Zealand have their own rules, their own regulations, their own risks. Their domestic flora and fauna are just being devastated by invasive species. They're large island nations. So they're taking an approach that is right for their country. That is not what we're considering here. And just so you know, NISC would not have the power to institute any regulations. We are a coordinating body. It would have to be the individual agencies with the actual regulatory authority, and they're the ones that would be instituting any additional protections. USDA, the Department of the Interior. Right now, just so people realize, very, very few invasive species are regulated at the federal level. That doesn't mean they can't be regulated at the state level, but only about 90 to 100 noxious weeds are actually listed on the noxious
weeds. It's not just weeds. It is animals as well, correct?
Well, that under USDA law, it's just the noxious weed list. That's a separate regulatory list. Then under you and under the Department of the Interior, there's only 17 species and genera that are listed as injurious animals.
Okay, I'm going to have to take a quick break, Lori, but when we come back, we'll follow this up. And we'll also talk about risk assessment and talk about in what kinds of invasive species we're talking about. This is the Food Chain. Michael Olson here. We have David Theodoropoulos, and we also have Lori Williams, and we have you, 800-624-2665, 831-479-1080. Right back.
Get this. The average acre of farmland in or near the city limits may earn in excess of $123,000 per year. To learn how so much can be earned from so little, pick up a copy of MetroFarm, the guide to growing for big profit on a small parcel of land. MetroFarm is the PMA Ben Franklin Book of the Year Award winner by Michael Olson that contains over 500 pages of photos, charts, checklists, illustrations, and in-depth interviews. MetroFarm will teach you how to develop a strategy, survey markets, select crops, organize business, establish production, prepare for market, and make the sale. MetroFarm will teach you how others just like you earn a good living by growing high-value specialty crops for people who are truly appreciative. Abraham Lincoln said, "The greatest fine art of the future will be the making of a comfortable living from a small parcel of land." Get in on that future today. Pick up a copy of MetroFarm at bookstores, lawn and garden supply stores, 1-800-624-BOOK, or at www.metrofarm.com.
Welcome back to What's Eating What Radio, right here on the Food Chain. Folks, sometimes wrong things are eating in the wrong places, in which case we tend to call them invasive species. And right now we have some 500 invasive species in this country that are wreaking approximately $138 billion in damage. And we're trying to figure out how to manage them. Should we manage them at all? Should we tolerate them or should we eliminate them? That's the question we have on the table today. You are invited to participate. We have David Theodoropoulos, the author of Invasion Biology.
Of a pseudoscience.
Okay. And also Lori Williams, Executive Director of the National Invasive Species Council. Lori, what is an invasive species? What are we talking about here? Can you give us some examples?
Invasive species, as defined by our executive order, which established the council, are those species that are both non-native, usually from another country, and transported here by some kind of human activity. And those non-native species that are harmful to the environment, to the ecology, or to animal and human health.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, so those are the species we're talking about. Certainly, as you pointed out, the vast majority of non-native species that are here, including a lot of our crops and foodstuffs and very important species, are not harmful and not invasive and not what we're talking about.
But it gets right down to it, we would starve to death if we did not have non-native species here in the country, because
we certainly are very dependent on non-native species, and that's not, obviously, we're not talking about dealing with all non-native species, only those species that are harmful, and then we take a close look at what's the appropriate thing to do. As I said, most of these species are not federally regulated, and actually not most of them are not even state regulated.
How do you decide which ones are invasive?
The invasive is looking and documenting that the harm that they cause, like a yellow star thistle, as you pointed out, which covers millions of acres, which forms a monoculture. That's all pretty much after you get
the
yellow star thistle.
The only thing that can grow there is yellow star. It's like eucalyptus. And for those of you who don't live on the California coastal area, we have a lot of eucalyptus that were brought into the country. And eucalyptus have this wonderful ability to chase everything away from their environment. And they do that by precipitating moisture out of the morning air. and that moisture rolls across their leaves and picks up eucalyptus oil, and it falls onto the ground, whereupon it kills everything else.
Well, that's not exactly true.
If you actually
read the science behind that, you find that studies have shown that eucalyptus groves in California are heavily used by native wildlife. They have abundant bird species diversity. In the study that was done on Angel Island before the feds came in and eliminated the eucalyptus forest there, which, by the way, they did over the objections of nearly everyone in the Bay Area, they found that, for example, in amphibians, the native salamanders were three times as abundant underneath eucalyptus. And in fact, 75% of all of the monarch overwintering clusters in California are in eucalyptus groves.
Mm-hmm.
And the eucalyptus groves are actually preferred by the monarchs because they provide food in the form of nectar, whereas the native conifers that the monarchs used to overwinter in provide no food. And studies have also shown that, contrary to the idea that eucalyptus suppresses the understory chemically, that eucalyptus mulch did not inhibit the germination of native plant seedlings. I even have, on my website, I have photographs of transects leading up to eucalyptus trunk showing an increasing percentage of cover of native species as you approach a eucalyptus trunk. Mm-hmm. Also abundant.
Well, okay, I grant you all of these, David. Let me ask you this.
Okay, but you see, we have to talk about reality here. There's objective reality, and if you actually look at the science behind invasive species, it's kind of like the search for the weapons of mass destruction,
okay.
Right? Now, do you believe...
So you're saying there is no such thing as an invasive species?
Well, first of
is
all,
that what
invasive
I'm hearing?
Species itself is a... In science, we call them non-operational constructs.
Mm-hmm. Should we call them undocumented species?
No, I would call them species.
Just
now,
species.
You can have species that have expanding populations that are native species. Now, Lori was claiming there that they are only concerned with non-native species. However, if you look at the NISC website, you'll find that they list, for example, Phragmites, which is a native, absolutely a native U.S. plant.
No, I didn't say that I'm only talking about. I said most species.
No, you said that the definition of an invasive species.
There are species
you said that
do very well in Florida that wouldn't survive in California, and we'd have to be concerned. This is a very large country with a lot of different ecosystems,
right,
and
so that
you can't
means,
just transport
words,
everything around without thinking of ecological impacts. I would just like to say that, you know, I think it's great to hear from David's point of view, but the Ecological Society of America, many famous scientists, including many renowned scientists from California, Joseph DiTomaso from Cal Davis, I could, you know, the list can go on and on. If people would like to contact me about the scientific founding of this, it goes back, you know, 30 years, if not longer, it's no problem. I just don't want people to get the impression that there's no science behind invasive species. There's certainly ways to challenge and consider and do more research on whether individual species are a problem or over time, have not become a problem where there's just you would do more harm eliminating them at
this point. Well, okay, let's look at some of the misinformation that's on the NISC website. For example, you claim that hydrilla is an aggressive invader in aquatic invader in Florida, and you claim that it stunts sport fish populations. It actually supports a high-yield fishery in Florida, and it has six times the fish density and five times the biomass of fish.
And where did this stuff come from?
Plants.
It would be very interesting for you to debate some
birds.
Of the people in Florida. The state of Florida is spending over $30 million a year of a very tight budget to deal with aquatic invasive species, such as hydrilla and others.
Let me pick it up, David. Let me ask you this. Do you think that it's possible for a non-native species to come into an environment and wreak such havoc that it will make it hard for us to grow crops? For example, the star thistle that seems to be taking over California. Do you think that it's possible that that we can still go on growing food and just allow a free access to all of these species?
Okay. Okay, let's clear that up. There absolutely are agricultural pest species. Now, we can't confuse an agricultural pest with an ecological harm. For example, star thistle stands are actually of more use to native wildlife than the forage grasses that they replace. Now, obviously, if you're...
What native wildlife utilize star thistle?
What?
Yeah. Who use... What animal life utilizes star thistle?
Well, again, you can go to my website.
Well, just tell us. We're not on your website right now.
Well, you can see photographs of the middens left by crusetted rodents, or native crusetted rodents that eat the seeds. The native birds eat the seeds. There are dozens of native pollinators whose populations increase when star thistle moves into an area. It's
so it's deer, what you're saying is
rabbit.
That it's possible to have for these species to have a deleterious impact on agriculture, but that their impact on the environment cannot be considered deleterious, even though it might have a profound change on that environment.
Yes, change does not equal harm. In many cases, these organisms
Lori, is that a fair way of putting it in your mind as well?
I think that what you're looking at and what you look at the impact of some of these species is it's not about bad species versus good species or killing species. It's about what are the habitat values that we're trying to protect. We spent billions of dollars trying to protect wetlands. Yet nutria, a very non-native, not from the U.S. species, that was brought here and released for the fur trade. Unfortunately, you don't see many people in nutria coats. So what happened is these species got out of control. They literally eat wetlands. They destroy wetlands.
Okay, got to take a quick break, Lori. When we come back, we'll pick that up. Do stay tuned, folks. 800-624-2665, 831-479-1080. Right back. Tolerate or eliminate? What do you think? This is the Food Chain. What's Eating What Radio? We're at 800-624-2665, 831-479-1080. We're talking about non-native species of plants and animals that come into our country, and we look at them and say some of them are just wreaking havoc upon our environment, and that we must do something about it. But we have David Theodoropoulos, who is the author of Invasion Biology, for short, and Lori Williams, Executive Director of the National Invasive Species Council. Before the break, we were talking about how the change that these critters make on the native environment may not be deleterious in nature. But what about when these changes have an impact on agriculture? And there's a situation here on the California Central Coast where we're faced with a light brown apple moth, which could have a profound change in the natural environment, and nobody really seems to mind that. But what we do seem to mind is the impact it could have on the nation, the salad bowl of the nation, which is the Salinas and Pajaro Valleys of the California Central Coast. So, Lori, does that have an impact on judging which non-native species become invasive non-native species?
Well, we try to look at the harm both caused to the environment and the ecology. And, of course, a lot of these species come from somewhere else or come from a new area, and they can be carrying parasites or diseases that our species don't have any exposure to. And that's a very dangerous thing. In some cases, they can even carry diseases that can then jump to human diseases, so-called zoonotic diseases. One of the things I want to emphasize is, rather than dealing species by species, one thing the council is really emphasizing is what simple steps people can take and what steps we can take to stop the pathways by which a number of these species come into the country, such as looking at and considering and treating solid wood packing material. That's where the Asian longhorn beetle came from. So if we deal or talking to hikers about cleaning their boots when they before they
stop bringing the material into the country, then we wouldn't have to worry.
Much more
Lori, do you think we can do that? I mean, given the And this is something that a lot of people bring up to me. This is just going to be impossible to stop these species coming in, or these pests from coming into the country, because we live in a new world order of open borders and world trade and airplanes that can take us from one side of the world to the other in a few hours.
Well, you're not going to stop them all, but you really can either stop or slow down some of them. And every time you keep one of these pests from coming into the United States or moving from the East Coast to the West Coast, like the green crab did, you can save counties and state governments, which bear the brunt of the control costs, millions of dollars. One species that the Department of Agriculture, through their inspection program, has kept out of California, knock on wood, I hope it's not there now, since if my information's old, is the giant African snail, which also can carry meningitis. If eaten. So,
David has a counter to that.
I'm sure.
Oh, no, I believe the disease that snail carries is schistosomiasis, but that's sort of beside the point. But I'd also like to say, here's something we agree on. For example, Lori's talking about pallets and raw saw logs, and it's like, yes, I absolutely support reasonable, rational steps to prevent the introduction of forest pests. We actually, Lori and I actually agree on a lot more than you would think, from judging from this conversation. And I'd also like to point out to Lori that the NISC has generally seen me as the enemy, when actually, if they paid attention to my work, they would see that I'm giving them the theoretical basis by which they'll be able to deal more effectively with these organisms.
Well,
and I would really encourage the NISD to stop spreading a one-sided hysterical message.
Well, let's go.
I disagree now, with spreading that, but I do think it's important
to
hear a variety
of viewpoints. Let's just take a look for a minute.
All right, kids, hold on. Let's go to the phones and see what our caller has to say. Mike, welcome to the Food Chain. Phone numbers today, if you'd care to join us, folks, 800-624-2665, 831-4798. Welcome to the Food Chain, Mike.
Hi, Mike. Thanks for the program today.
You bet.
I wanted to check with Lori. The executive order you referred to was 13112 by Bill Clinton?
That's it.
Yeah. Okay. And now, we should realize out here in the radio land that your invasive species organization comes about by presidential dictum. Nobody asked for this. This did not go through Congress. This president just decided to establish this. And I think that
isn't that the job of presidents once in a while to decide things?
By executive order, no. The executive orders really are it's a tool that presidents can use to streamline their own branch of government, the executive branch. This reaches into the microcosms of everybody's life.
Well, one thing I'd like to point out, you're very right in this sense, and that's why I wanted to stress that the National Invasive Species Council does not regulate anything. Any regulation of invasive species would have to go through the agency with congressional authority granted to it. And I'm very clear on that, because one of the things we were supposed to do was have all the agencies work better together, so we would avoid some of the inefficiencies and make sure that the agencies were doing what they did best. So I don't know if I'd call it streamlining, but it's certainly one of our major jobs is coordination and planning. We are not out there managing invasive species. I got 5 people. The country's got 50 states. You know, we're really supposed to be making the overall federal efforts more efficient. And I agree with you. Executive orders cannot provide any kind of legislative authority, and we don't have that.
Mike?
That just sounded like a lot of slipping and sliding.
What is your point?
This is completely unconstitutional, what she is pushing on us here. She should define the Invasive Species Council as including the Secretary of Defense, the Secretary of Treasury, the Secretary of State, the Interior, Agriculture, Commerce, the Secretary of Transportation.
So what do you think they're up to, Dave? What do you think they're up to, Mike?
Well, it's like they've got everybody in on the act. Every aspect of our society is covered under this, and they can pretty well regulate us any which way they want. And then we have to realize...
Lori, you got your work cut out for you.
Yeah, I do. We have to realize... we don't regulate anything. We have, as you said, no executive order.
So, Mike, hold on for a second. Lori, why is the Secretary of Defense involved?
Well, it's very interesting, but think of the thousands of pieces of military equipment that the Secretary of Defense transfers all over the world. And one of the ways we think some species... completely unintentionally, got to both Guam, the brown tree snake, and into New Orleans, very damaging termites was on military equipment. So now the military has a very extensive program to make sure they clean all their equipment before it comes back to the U.S. so they will not be spreading invasive species. That's a very positive thing. The other thing is if military has jurisdiction over much land in the United States.
Okay, we're going to have to take a quick break, Lori, but that's a pretty good answer. We will be right back. Please do stay tuned. 800-624-2665 831-479-1080. Right back. We are a nation of immigrants, but that doesn't mean that we're all nice immigrants. Some immigrants are not nice at all, and we call them invasive. So what do we do with invasive non-native species that come into our country and cause so much damage, $168 billion a year in estimated damages? Do we tolerate them or do we eliminate them? David, I'd like to go quickly to you before we go back to Mike.
I'd really like to address that so-called $137 billion
cost.
That was a paper by David Pimentel at Cornell, and it was that was totally debunked years ago. It's just an amazing number padding. He's doing completely fictitious so-called costs that have absolutely no basis in reality.
Yeah, I probably couldn't count that high myself anyway.
Yeah, plus he, government agencies often will engage in an extermination project and use the money they spent on the extermination project to justify more spending, even though these projects may be completely ineffective. For example, hundreds of millions of dollars were spent on the MIREX program to stop the fire ant, but it actually helped spread the fire ant.
Mm-hmm.
They spent $100 million.
Well, okay, let me ask you this. Let me ask you this, David. You suggest or seem to suggest that the impact these critters have on the environment cannot really be seen as good or bad. They're just a change. That's what they are. But what about the impact they have on the agricultural environment? Do you think that once these critters get loose in the environment that we somehow must tolerate them or must we eliminate them so that our agriculture can proceed to deliver the goods we need to survive?
Well, obviously something that's a clear and present threat to an agricultural crop, you'll try to eliminate it, and if it can't be prevented or eliminated, you'll obviously work to make just like every farmer practically sprays now. But we also have to look at the benefits.
Well, not every farmer now. I mean, there are a lot of farmers that do not use pesticides anymore.
Yeah, we should all be working towards a more sustainable, healthy, organic agriculture. But, for example, when they're counting the cost, they talk about, there might be $100 million in costs from the zebra mussel because it fouls intake pipes and such. But the zebra mussel, using Pimentel's methods, has probably caused $30 billion worth of cleanup of the water in Lake Erie. So it's increased native fisheries. It's cleared the water column. It's a food for native waterfowl.
So we'll have to bring Pimentel
along. Like a lot of states don't know what they're doing. So you're saying that a lot of these states that are spending all this money to deal with these things that literally clog water intake pipes.
Absolutely.
They're just wasting their money. They don't know what they're doing. And
Don't mischaracterize what I'm saying, Lori. Let Lori have her word.
You had yours, David. Let Lori have her word.
I think what's really important to think about in terms of this, just like a lot of problems that we face, we have to look at them very carefully and decide what's the appropriate mechanism. Maybe it's education. Please don't take your Burmese python and release it at National Everglades Park. That's what happened, and we have three breeding populations of python that have a very broad range and may go up to Alabama is the estimated range. So just don't release your pets. The Garden Clubs of America have taken a very strong stand on this. There's a little brochure you can download from the PlantWise website just to see simple steps that you can take and in your local area to minimize the introduction and spread of these plants.
Okay, let's go quickly to the phone. Mike, you had a quick follow-up?
Again, that executive order number is 13112. I just want to give that so people can read that and
mm-hmm.
see. You cannot read through this and get the idea that there is no regulation involved. This Section 1B defines control.
Do you think it's kind of immoral for the government to try to coordinate the efforts for all of the federal agencies with respect to invasive species?
Completely. Lori gives the example of, the military should be careful not to bring bugs back with them. Well, that's very nice. But there are so many other things that could become really problematic for us as
a
society.
Okay, I got you. Thank you very much, Mike, for the comment. Let's go quickly to David. David, welcome to the food chain. Oops, I better press this button. David, welcome to the food chain.
Yeah, I'm here.
Go ahead.
I have a question, but before I ask the question, I just want to mention in case there's time, I live in the Great Lakes region, and after I ask my question, I'd also like to go back to Mr. Theodoropoulos' statement about the zebra mussel.
Please, fire away.
Okay, well, first my question. I'm trying to understand Mr. Theodoropoulos' background. I've gone on his website. I've looked at a bunch of stuff, and he says he's a conservation biologist. He has a lot of written stuff, but nowhere have I found anything stating what his actual professional credentials or training.
David?
I've had 30 years experience in conservation biology. What else does he want? I'm a member of a number of scientific societies. What?
Do you have any academic degrees, or is your expertise self-generated? That's all I'm asking.
Absolutely. I've never claimed I have an academic degree.
Okay, that's why it's not on there, then. I was just curious.
Okay, your quick comment before we go to the break, then.
Okay, the zebra mussel, he said it's done things like, cleared up, or I think he said cleaned up, I'm not sure which, but the thing about the zebra mussel is it didn't clean up the Great Lakes. What it did is it cleared the water. In doing so, it concentrated toxins which have gotten into the food chain, and there are massive waterfowl die-offs along Lake Erie now in Lake Michigan. It's also appears to be related, and the science behind this is still trying to figure out the cause, but there's clearly a correlation between the zebra mussel and the loss of a small amphipod throughout the Great Lakes. It's been there since they were formed. That is
okay. I'm going to have to take a quick break, but we'll be right back. I'll pick you up and we'll finish this, David.
Okay.
Mike Lolson, this is the Food Chain. Please do stay tuned. We will be right back. Well, we're back. This is the Food Chain. Michael Olson here. We have a few minutes left, so we're going to go quickly right now to David. David, you want to finish your comment?
Let me just summarize. My point is that Mr. Theodoropoulos is correct that the zebra mussel has made the Great Lakes in the summer look very beautiful, very clear. The water is very clear. It looks like the Caribbean. But along with that positive thing has been the number of negative things that are affecting our use of the ecosystem. In fact, during the winter, sometimes the beaches get so littered with broken zebra mussel shells that the beaches can't be used until they're cleaned by the local municipality. All that costs money. So it's not just a simple thing of benefit or negative. It's really a balance. And I'd like to say this is part of the problem with this whole issue is we use the word invasive really to mean a species that is likely to cause or is causing harm to either the ecosystem or whatever, but it's being applied so commonly to non-native or non-indigenous species that there's a confusion. And, for example, on his seed imports, I'm sure that there's probably 90-some-odd percent of what he wants to import may be perfectly harmless and benign where they're going to be grown. The other question would be, though, is he willing to take financial responsibility for a species that he sells that gets out of hand and starts costing municipalities or whatever.
David, you gotta pay the bill on those?
That's a whole other can of worms.
Okay,
that,
well, let's hold that and let's go to...
I'd like to also point out that, you know, if he's attacking my academic credentials, that we should point out that Lori Williams has a background in law and has no experience or qualifications.
Okay, you're both bad children. Let's go to Mark on the cell phone. Mark?
Yeah, hello. Great show. I live in coastal California, and if I go south of Monterey on Highway 1 down to the Big Sur area, it's just... beautiful natural area. It goes anything from coastal redwoods to coastal chaparral down to a marine environment in a very small space. But right now, if I go down there, I see hillsides just full of pampas grass, which would be fine, you know, if I lived in Argentina. I go down to the marine environment, I see the beach is covered with hottentot fig, which is ice plant, which would be fine if I lived in South Africa. This is not the natural environment of the Big Sur, and that's not, you know, what the tourists or myself are down there to see. We want to see what California was, and you know, hopefully
That's a real interesting point. David, let's go quickly to you and have Lori finish up. David?
I'd like to suggest that the gentleman study a little paleobiology, and that'll clear his mind of this nonsense about native.
Okay, David, how do we get in touch with you?
Just go to dtheo.org.
dtheo.org
or invasion biology.
And Lori Williams?
Yes.
We'll stop bringing in invasive species, right?
We can do a lot to prevent and reduce our cost in dealing with these species.
And how do we get in touch with you?
Lori, L-O-R-I underscore Williams at ios.doi.gov.
Okay, folks, this has been The Food Chain. We've been talking about the non-native species that come into our country and kind of run amok, as it were, go through the environment. Do you think we can keep them out of our world? Or do you think with the new world order of open borders and world trade and airplanes that fly from one place to the other in a matter of minutes that we can keep things out, and perhaps maybe we should just learn to live with them and adapt, as it were? And if that's the case, how do we grow our food? And all kinds of fun questions right here on What's Eating What Radio. Remember, cheap food isn't. Stay tuned next week for more.
You've been listening to the award-winning Food Chain Show with Michael Olson. If your friends missed the show today, tell them to log on to the radio page at www.metrofarm.com for a listen. Now go out and find some food with a farmer's face on it and live.